Welcome to the Command Line Podcast for November 27th, 2011. I'm your host, Thomas Command Line Gideon, a self-proclaimed hacker, eccentric, and hacktivist. This is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing on well over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of technology with society and public policy, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. This episode is a feature cast, and in it I have what I finally decided on sharing first, the conversation that Chris Miller, a good friend of mine, friend of the podcast, who's been on this show repeatedly, the conversation that we had inspired by his watching of Ken Burns' documentary, Prohibition. He had some questions about potential parallels. We got into some actual contrasts, some differences between liquor laws under prohibition here in the U.S. and copyright law here currently, all around this notion of scoff laws, which we define at the outset, and then try to translate and figure out if there's a digital equivalent of that. Our conversation also, I think, acts as a good follow-on to my last rant about how copyright is becoming toxic. In a way, it helps us kind of go back to basics and understand the laws as they are, and then flowing from that, the confusion that often arises. It's also a reminder of why I stay engaged with intellectual property policy. I still read on it. I still discuss it with my colleagues, and I still act where possible, even if it's just as simple as sitting down with a creator like Chris, who is a writer of many stripes. He's an aspiring novelist with a fantastic bit of historical fiction that he's working on right now. But I run into creators like Chris all the time at various venues, whether I'm public speaking or on a panel or at a networking event of some kind, just out of my own interest, because I have a very diverse set of interests. And I'm happy to be the person in the room trying to clarify where people may get into trouble, what they need to be aware of if they want to take action like me to try to make things better, to make the overall system work better in alignment with, I think, the high-level goals a lot of us can agree on in terms of rewards for creators, to give them incentive to actually create, but also to allow access to knowledge into our shared cultural heritage, so things that build up a certain cultural traction and relevance remain accessible instead of locked away. But I'm getting ahead of myself, and we'll cover a lot of this ground in the conversation because it is long. It's a solid half hour. There is no new hacker word of the week, and I'm guessing probably because of the holiday here in the U.S., there really isn't any listener feedback to get into. One last thing real quick before I do share the conversation with you is a reminder that I will be in Paris the week of December 5th. I'm actually leaving Saturday the 3rd midday, so I doubt very much that I'm going to get a podcast out next week. Hopefully, though, I have a bit of audio from another friend of mine and friend of the podcast and frequent guest on the podcast, Cory Doctorow, on deck. And I'm going to be pursuing that this week with the multimedia producer at work, who also just happens to be John Taylor Williams, my co-host and the producer of the other podcast that I do, the Living Proof Brewcast. The audio that we captured was the book event that I mentioned in the last podcast, sort of an interview around context from which I've done a couple of readings. So I hope to be able to get that from John in a form that I can get that worked up. So not on the 4th, when the next show would go out, but on the 11th, after my return from my travels to Paris, hopefully I'll have that ready to go and can put a show out, despite being jet-lagged, with a decent amount of interesting content to share, and then hopefully get back onto the regular rotation between the newscasts and the feature casts after that. Chris Miller approached me with a very interesting idea. He was watching Ken Burns' wonderful documentary, Prohibition, and this got him to thinking what parallels there might be between the sorts of question that the 19th Amendment raised in terms of the moral authority of law and norms around kind of the drinking culture and how they shifted, and what we're dealing with today when we talk about online piracy, something that I've been talking about with increasing urgency with bills like the Stop Online Piracy Act and the Protect IP Act. And so we thought it would be cool to sit down with some beer or some coffee and just have a bit more of a casual discussion, given it's kind of a low-key week here in the States for the holiday, and just kind of talk through what seemed like a really interesting, crunchy topic.
Well, thanks for getting together with me, Thomas. This was, as I sat and watched the show, I first found out about it actually from you and some of the things that you were talking about via some of the discussions on the Living Proof Brewcast and just some of your posts on the various social networks. And when I was able to actually sit down, one of the things that grabbed me was the term scofflaw, which I had not heard before. And the idea of that as a term for someone who did not recognize the moral authority of a given legal statute and who decided to act counter to that statute, whether publicly or privately, I found to be, frankly, just fertile ground, because I know there are several folks, I know I'm probably one of them, there are other folks that maybe bend or break the rules here and there when it comes down to some digital content, some media that they get online, that sort of thing. And I'm sort of, I guess the main thrust that I wanted to get to is in the readings that you've been doing and a lot, you know, your work during the day, what's your interaction with kind of your everyday person that has to deal with the new legal statutes as they're coming down, things like SOPA, items like that, even going back to the DMCA, are people not just choosing not to recognize the moral authority of the law because it's a corporate gig, or because, you know, they don't understand why it should apply, or are people just kind of like going thumbing their noses and saying, you know what, I can do whatever I want with my computer and my data, screw you?
I think there's as much to be learned in the differences between the prohibition here in the States, the 30 some odd years where we had kind of a similar sort of set of circumstances. But I think that there are some profound differences, and this is a good place to start in talking about kind of those instructive differences, is that I think it's when you talk about the legality or illegality of consuming and distributing alcohol as a scarce good, as a tangible good, it's fairly evident when you are not breaking the law. So that idea of a scofflaw, of somebody who says, I full well know what the law is, but I don't recognize that in the case of prohibition, that the state has the right, the purview to legislate moral behavior, legislate morality even. It wasn't even necessarily behavior. The teetotalers, the anti-saloon league, they definitely, it was about values, not as well as it was about actions. It wasn't just about harms, which in my view, I think laws really should be more about outcomes. And harms is one way of thinking about it. And we have a wonderful body of case law that's very deep and really helps the judicial system in this country get to the bottom of things in a way that doesn't have to speak as much to moral values per se. I set that all up by way of saying that I don't know that scofflaw is going to apply as evenly when you talk about people who are consuming digital content through illegitimate or non-legitimate channels. I think that some of it, to be sure, to your point, there are people who know full well, there are more technically savvy, more technically aware, or people who've just had some experience that has given them the opportunity to understand this is the state of things, that the DMCA has what may seem like, based on kind of norms of online use, kind of silly provisions in it, and the newer laws, even more so, some of the trade agreements like ACTA also are kind of pushing. But I think it's a little bit more complicated. There's still some parallels, because prohibition also dealt with kind of the distribution system. Burns did such a great job showing kind of the warehouses, you know, all the liquor that had not been distributed yet and was warehoused, and some of the kind of legal trickery some of the scofflaws used to liberate those booze and then hijack it illegally and then feed that into the bootlegging system. So, you know, there's a corporate angle to a lot of these laws, and that's probably the easier space to look at a little bit legitimately to say if there's a commercial pirate, a domestic or foreign, or a corporation that's behaving in a way where it really should be licensing content instead of just using it at will. That makes a little bit more sense. I think when it scales down to the individual, it starts to break down. And my real point is the difference is I don't know that a lot of people really understand. They think that, you know, a personal copy, personal lending of digital media is fine, because for analog stuff, it has been. So we have this kind of very critical difference there that I would say that I would say I think the majority of people that are falling afoul of these laws that are technically infringing, breaking these laws, aren't scofflaws because they're not aware of how technically these laws actually operate.
Yeah, I think you bring up a fair point. One of the things that I find curious about this, and this is going back maybe even a decade when Napster was starting to come out and the idea of sharing digital content was just kind of coming to the forefront. You had the argument that sharing music is wrong. Not illegal, wrong. And I'm wondering, do you think that in the past 10 years, it's shifted to move away from that kind of a moral stance of the wrongness of an action versus the, well, it's not licensed and it, you know, you really have to pay so much to the artist and so much to the distributor and so much for the publisher. And this is really how the law is supposed to work. So that it's more of a legal argument than, like you say, that moral argument where, as during Prohibition with the Anti-Saloon League and stuff, it was very much a prevalently Christian morality that was driving a lot of the people who wanted to go to something more prohibitive than the current saloon like model. Is that the best term for what they're doing? Than the saloons, I guess is what I'm saying.
I think the parallels start to break down a little bit because you're dealing with rivalrous goods in the case of alcohol and prohibition. You're dealing with arguably, you know, set aside the moral part, which was most problematic and caused the most strife in the later years with that. But just look at the harms, say. So the harms to communities that saloons did because they became these centers of young male hooligans, you know, shenanigans, that there was violence and all kinds of problems and provable harm to the community. I think it's harder to come in and make similar kinds of arguments about harms if you factor even the morals back in, which is, I think, actually, to be fair, that's what you were getting at. I don't know that, I mean, the only moral concept I'm familiar with in this space really is plagiarism. And plagiarism has as much to do about taking credit as it does about copying. It's not enough to copy something to trigger a moral complaint of plagiarism. You have to copy it and then say, that's mine. And so, you know, in the face of somebody saying, no, that's Chris Miller's, that's the novel he's writing, I've read a draft of it. And I go, no, that's my novel. That's the draft I'm writing. That's morally wrong. That's plagiarism. It's the difference between infringement and plagiarism. Infringement and a lot of stuff that we're talking about under copyright, these are not inherently moral concepts. They are economic concepts. They are legal concepts. And it gets a little bit muddier because in some jurisdictions, they do recognize the moral rights of the author. But again, that also, that's splitting another hair. Copying doesn't necessarily trigger that directly. Mm-hmm. It's really the moral rights has to do with what the author's right is to object to certain uses of the work. So if you think about here in the U.S., we've had, I think it was John McCain using Jackson Browne's music, and then more recently, Michelle Bachmann using American Girl by Tom Petty. And both of those artists, maybe more left-leaning and not so happy that candidates on the right are using them. If they were in France, for instance,
they would actually have a moral and a legal stance to stand on to say that that's my moral right in the work. It's representing something that I object to, that I do not wish it to be associated with. You have to stop doing that. And that's both moral and because France and other countries signed on to the convention that encodes that into law, there are legal rights around the moral rights of the authors as well. In the U.S., not so much. And I think the other point I'll make in this vein about muddying the waters is I don't think that the intermediaries whose business models are failing and who are pushing these laws are above trying to make it come across as if it's a moral argument. So you see this this propaganda film that came out recently from I think it was NBC Universal or Paramount's. I can't remember which, and I will find the copy of it that I saw, which actually wasn't the original copy. It was a copy that Lauren Weinstein had put subtitles on to correct a lot of the bogus assertions in this video. But the point is the original video, as made and distributed, is trying to make these kind of quasi-moral arguments about. You wouldn't want to put, you know, poor Jimmy the gaffer out of work. You wouldn't want to put poor Jenny the boom mic operator out of work. Why would you pirate music? You know, you're taking money away from these poor people who otherwise would not have jobs. And it's not, in my view, of course, I'm very much on the other side of this. It's not a very compelling moral argument because it's not, it's muddy. You know, it's muddy at best. I think that there are economic arguments about people's opportunities to work and right to a living and things like that. I don't know how clear a moral concept that is. And again, I don't know that directly sits on top of copying, you know, digital copying, analog copying, any form of copying or access to work. So it's I think it's a bit more complicated. That's I guess my takeaway.
I think I do agree. I mean, it's definitely not as black and white as the moral harm argument, though. It does make me wonder. You know, we talk about shifting slightly more to copyright than digital rights. Talking about how copyright is being extended more and more for various, you know, pieces, Disney, et cetera, et cetera, and them not passing into the commons. Do you think there's an argument of harm to be made that if things are not allowed to pass into the commons, it actually harms a culture?
Yeah, I do think so. I think that it's probably a bit easier to make moral arguments about commons if you're read up on the history of commons in the form of, say, medieval markets. So medieval markets had mechanisms that tended towards sort of moral, social, and communal goods. So there were hours where the markets had to operate with certain constraints so that the poorest in the community could come into the market and could afford to acquire the goods that they needed, foodstuffs and the like, to subsist, to survive. Whereas if they came in when the market was open more generally, during the unconstrained portion of the market day, they wouldn't be able to do so. You know, the price that the market would gravitate towards was out of reach of the poorest in the community. And I think that there's definitely a moral angle, if one that's kind of cemented in this idea of the commons as the heart of a community. So if you look at a copyright commons, the public domain, as kind of the heart of a culture, then yeah, I do think that there is a case to be made for a moral argument about this is our culture, you know, that we, if not for the consuming public, Disney would not have created the things that they did. They wouldn't see the value that they did. There was an exchange, an interaction. And then because especially in the case when you talk about Disney as being one of the worst offenders of trying to continue pushing the extension of copyright to keep things out of the public domain, there's a kind of an implicit recognition, there's a counter intuition there about that they get that there's a really strong cultural currency, that there's an attachment by artists out there who want access to those works, to those characters, not because they want to take money away from Disney, not because they want to undertake commercial piracy, but because there's a significance, there's a communication significance to, say, using Bambi, or the Disney version of Snow White, or even Mickey Mouse himself, in terms of what they represent, you know, the kind of nuance somebody can craft into a work using those components rather than, say, using some generic cartoon mouse or something along those lines.
I remember the case years ago of the preschool that had put Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck on the walls of their the walls of the preschool inside the building, and Disney coming after this preschool just because they were using the content and it was not licensed. And I found that sad, but I guess in an era where you have to license all of this cultural content, is there any other option? I mean, they have to keep hitting everybody they can with the law, because if they breach it once, it kind of sets a precedent, doesn't it?
Well, no. We need to back up a little bit to clarify a couple of things here. And this is, unfortunately, this is kind of some of the muddying that I'm talking about, not necessarily on the moral side, but also on the legal and the economic side that feeds into kind of norms and perceptions. And unfortunately, I think that in the case of Disney, in the case of some of the larger content companies, they prey on this sort of confusion. They prey on the conception that somebody thinks that if you don't defend your copyright, it dilutes in some way. That's not true. That's only true of trademark. And trademark differs in one key critical aspect in terms of its intent, why it exists from copyright. So copyright is there so that there's some leverage that a creator can use to help generate and enable and participate in markets for their works so they can get some sort of benefit, some sort of reward. And the idea is that this bargain encourages them to create and to continue creating. Trademark is different. Trademark, so you see, Mickey Mouse, trademark of Disney. You see a Mickey Mouse character and you see a little trademark symbol. This is about consumer safety and consumer confusion. So the trademark is meant to say, this is Disney's Mickey Mouse. This is not a counterfeit. This is not a knockoff. This is not a school putting it on their wall without permission. And trademark, you do have to defend or it dilutes. You do have to actively defend it, or that can devolve into the public domain and those trademarks become no longer protectable. This is why Xerox for years got very uppity about people using that term to refer to photocopying, because it was diluting the Xerox brand and it was making it far harder for them to defend that trademark. There's another aspect to this, though, another piece of confusion above and beyond the purposes and the mechanisms of how these work, but that blurring of what is a cop, what can be covered under copyright, what can be covered under trademark, and what can be covered under patent. And it feeds into, I think, exactly what you put your finger on, what Lawrence Lessig calls this permission of default. This assumption that no matter what it is, if a corporate interest can lay claim to it, whether it's a mark, a work, an invention, doesn't matter. If they think it's an idea in some form or an expression of that idea in some form, there's an assumption that you have to pay for it. And there are supposed to be, so if we set those confusions aside that make it so much harder for schools to figure out where they're within their rights to use characters or not, there's there's supposed to be mechanisms. The public domain we touched on is one of them. There's fair use under copyright. There's a very narrower idea of fair use when talking about trademarks. So if you're doing a review or you're referring to a specific product, you're not, again, kind of comparable to the point I was making about the moral conception of plagiarism. You're not making any claims that a trademark good is yours and you're putting it out there, but you're just discussing it and you need to refer to it very specifically by its trademark name. That's covered under a form of fair use. It says that's okay because you're not identifying that as something you're distributing. You're just talking about it and you need to speak about it with a certain specificity. So it's tough to untangle. And I think this feeds back to the point that I was trying to make is, so, like someone like me, someone like you to a certain degree, other people who are listening to this may understand aspects of this and may say, this is BS. We're supposed to have limits and exceptions on these bodies of intellectual property protections so that we can kind of nibble away at the edges and make some minimal uses, some personal uses of this, these kinds of things, and we're being shut out from that. Formerly were undiscoverable uses and such just didn't rise to the point where they triggered law. That's being eradicated by, I think, really by the internet.
As Burns pointed out in the Prohibition documentary, that it took years to kind of get these laws, the amendment itself passed. Some, if I remember correctly, it was almost a 50-year span, perhaps a little bit more, since the beginning of kind of an anti-saloon movement to actually passing the amendment. We see lawmakers pushing new forms of law out there to protect content. And I say protect in quotes, Protect IP Act, SOPA, things like that. Do you think that, and I think you probably have a really good view of this based on what you do for a living and in your own interests, do you think that the movement to, protect in quotes, content is gaining strength, losing strength, or is it kind of caught at a standstill against culture, activism, and folks who would prefer to see things go the other way?
I don't know that it's gaining strength as such. I think that the entertainment industry wields a disproportionate amount of influence, and I think that there's a couple of reasons for that. I mean, they're by one measure, as of a few years ago, they were 1/40th the size of the tech sector. Which is just, it's mind-boggling that the things that they've pushed for, private rights of action, legislated technology solutions like DRM, that have knock-on effects on an industry that is, you know, almost half an order of magnitude larger than they are, is just patently ridiculous. But I think part of that is that they get communication, they get political lensing, and they've been so involved with the lobbying system for so much longer than a lot of other industries, save maybe like Big Pharma, that it makes a certain amount of sense. And I think that, I don't know that they have more power per se, but they're definitely bringing more pressure, and they seem more desperate in my view. And I think that's because they went to WIPO to get the WIPO treaty passed in the mid-90s that culminated here in the U.S. and the DMCA, and for the goals that they were trying to accomplish, for the outcomes they were trying to craft, to a certain degree, that worked all right. You know, the takedown system, for all its flaws, generally works fairly well, and you see some better implementations and some better examples, like Content ID on YouTube. It's getting better. It still doesn't recognize and make enough allowance for fair use, but a lot of the digital copyright legislation on the books and being proposed just like to completely ignore fair use and other exceptions and limitations on copyright that we've had traditionally. But the takedowns generally, outside of the abuses, work fairly well. There's some clever sort of experimentation, so YouTube lets you either leave it alone, and not a lot of people realize that a rights holder can just say, no, I'm fine with that use. That's okay. Because again, to what I was saying earlier, there's no dilution. You can let one person use your copyright and the next person not. And it doesn't grant, you know, any more or less rights to you, the rights holder, or any more or less rights to somebody wanting to use it down the line. It's the same. It's invariant over time. There's kind of an implicit recognition of that. There's a third option that's been built in beyond the leave it alone, take it down. There's also the, well, slap an ad on it and let's share a little bit of revenue, you know, which kind of gets at some of the economic arguments about copyright systems, that the ones that work best are the ones that just generally produce more public good, more social good. So it's not necessarily just the artists or the rights holder, but everybody overall is better off. And that kind of third option to me is starting to speak to maybe some emerging economic thought around that kind of, but more in practice rather than some of the theoretics that we read about, some of the fantastic scholarly treatises that have come out.
You know, it's interesting just talking this through with you and actually mainly asking you questions. I didn't anticipate this being almost an interview of you, but it's just it's just sort of going that way because I you know, I'm finding the holes in my own knowledge as we sit and talk here. You know, it's I find it interesting that there are some interesting or at least maybe some implied parallels between the what happened during Prohibition and what's happening now. But as you say, the root causes are radically different,
yeah.
That they're more economic and corporate based than personally or morally based. I'm sort of curious to ask, what do you think the future of this struggle is? With Prohibition, they got the laws passed, they stayed in for a good long time. People got fed up, and then people made changes and campaigned to try to get things reversed. What's interesting in that dynamic was that they weren't fighting, megalithic corporations with far more power than a group of individuals could put together, unless those individuals themselves are quite powerful. How do you see the balance of power in this these days?
Well, I've been making a lot of hay out of the differences, in particular this wonderful term, the scofflaw, and what it implies about normative behavior and whether that's ignorant or aware of the state of laws that inform that normative behavior. But to bring it kind of back to the similarities and kind of to your last question as well, because you were asking about kind of, do you think their power is getting greater, and is this going to lead to a similar sort of decades-long struggle until we get some reclamation of the public domain, some reclamation of kind of personal use exceptions and things like that. And I think that at a minimum, yeah, it's going to be a while. And I think that also very similar to the way that the 21st Amendment came about, it's going to have to become highly politicized. And I think we're starting to see that we're on the cusp a little bit, that you had Daryl Issa and Lundgren in the Senate in the wake of the SOPA hearings come forward. And Issa actually very strongly said this bill is just, it's completely flawed. It should not pass. That there are just too many problems. It interferes too much with the way the internet works. And all of the innovation that the American economy currently so strongly relies on, so this cannot stand. And so he's crossing the aisle and siding with more traditional defenders of kind of the consumer good. Lundgren's maybe not quite there yet. Lundgren said that he just thinks that it deserves more debate, but he wasn't ready to throw the baby out with the bathwater, as it were. So I think you're gonna. It's the problem is that copyright's never really been a voting issue. And I think it's going to have to get to a point where it's a voting issue. And I do have a little bit of optimism, and I'll tell you why. That there was a great piece in The Guardian by a friend of the podcast and a good friend of mine, Cory Doctorow, talking about how we really shouldn't be talking about IP laws and IP policy anymore. We should be talking about tech policy. But then even that isn't enough because everything is becoming increasingly mediated by technology, usually in the form of a digital networked computer, that we really should just be talking about policy. So if somebody comes up with a law like SOPA, Protect IP, I think if either of these pass in some form, the pessimist in me says that's not going to be the end of it because it's not solving the core problem. It's not the kind of legislative compromises that we've seen in the past for disruptive innovations. So an allowance for a new creation to flourish, but not entirely at the expense of existing markets and existing players. These laws don't do that. There isn't none of them have mandatory license built in, mandatory royalties built in that kind of cross subsidize the new against the old. They're all kind of one-sided, and it says the incumbents have newer and bigger clubs. And from what we've seen from the laws that they did manage to get passed from the DMCA, primarily in the U.S., they haven't worked because they don't address the core problem. It makes sense when you think about it that way. They've been abject failures. They haven't fixed the business models. They haven't fixed those things that cause people to seek out pirate outlets and other illegitimate outlets. So I think that unfortunately, we'll see more pressure, we'll see more panic, we'll see more desperation. But I think the silver lining is the more they do things that really interfere with just core policy, the more it will become, maybe not directly, but it really will become much more of a voting issue, that Hollywood's coming in here and trying to interfere with the way that we connect with each other, we connect with businesses, we connect with society at large. The more they get in the way of that, I think the more they're actually going to start to pay rope out, by which eventually they're going to be hung on this issue.
Well, thank you for taking the time out of the holiday and sitting and chatting with me. This actually gives me a lot of food for thought. It's as someone who creates content and as someone who has a spouse who creates content and has to start thinking about, you know, just these kind of issues. It really does kind of highlight the things that I need to be paying attention to. So thank you for that. I appreciate it.
Sure. It's my pleasure. These are, as you say, these are things that I've been following for years out of interest, and I'm very fortunate. And given the holiday that we just observed here in the U.S., I'm very thankful. I'm very grateful for the fact that it's now my career. And so beyond just following the stories out of interest, commenting on the stories, and maybe occasionally being able to participate, I'm actually getting to work much more inside the Beltway, much more directly on these issues. But at the same time, I'm still happy to talk to my friends that are in situations like you just described. You're not the only friend of mine who, you know, as you're well aware, many of our friends are very creative and should be aware and should be engaged and asking questions. And I also don't want to imply, as strong as some of my views are and as critical as they are of kind of the traditional intermediaries, I don't want to limit the conversation to pirate, not pirate, you know, legitimate or illegitimate. I think that this is a really complex issue, and there are a lot of people that are doing fantastic work at the edges that are using some aspects of traditional systems, traditional intermediaries, publishers, labels, and the like, and some innovation. And there's room for creatives. There should be room, I think, really, for creatives to find a level that they're most comfortable with. If they want to work with the more traditional model, fine. If they want to work with something totally experimental, they want to be an Amanda Palmer who does like no two albums are released in the same way, that should be fine. And everything in between.
That's all I've got for you, Thomas. you're making my head spin, which is a good thing. It gives me something to chew on for the next couple of weeks until the next time I pester you.
Sure. Well, it's all in all, it's my pleasure. I'm happy to geek out, and if that's of benefit to you, if that's of benefit to the listeners, then I'm always happy to delve into this. And if you have more questions, whether you want to come back on the show and we talk about them, or you just want to deal with them more one-on-one as they get more kind of into the weeds and more specific to what you and your wife are doing, as always, I'm happy to offer my time to help out.
Thanks.
That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening. And if you enjoyed the program, please do tell a friend. Or go to the website at thecommandline.net and click on the support link for all the ways you can financially help out with the production of the show. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback at thecommandline.net, or you can post those as a comment up on the website. If you're away from your computer and the internet at the moment, call the listener comment line at area code 240-949-2638. If you need to get in touch with me securely, details of my public key pair can be found at thecommandline.net/GNUPG-fingerprints. As I mentioned in the intro, I'm going to be traveling the 3rd and the 4th, so unlikely to be a show on that Sunday. So the next show will probably be Sunday the 11th, if everything comes to plan, with a bit of audio, live event audio, featuring Cory Doctorow. So until then, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank the Internet Archive for media hosting and bandwidth. The views expressed on this program are my own, and where applicable, those of my guests, and in no way reflect those of my employer or anyone else. This show is produced from 100% recycled bits. Except where noted, permission to recycle those further is granted under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license.
that means you're free to change this show as much as you like, as long as you don't alter credits and you share your changes under the same license.